Well, hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of All Good in the Brotherhood podcast. I am Brother Francisco Whitaker, and joining me today is a very unique and special guest. I've been very excited for today. Is my own abbot, Archabbot Martin de Porres Bartel, who is the 12th abbot. Is that correct?
I think so.
Okay, the 12th abbot of St. Vincent, and he was elected just like the president. not quite the same. Although, I don't know, the division in parties in the monastery maybe just over 4 years ago, correct?
Correct, June of 2020.
So it was right before I took first vows. And
that's right.
Archbishop Martin was installed formally as the abbot by the bishop the very morning that I took vows, which was pretty cool. So I was the very first monk he received into profession after becoming an abbot, which is pretty cool. So we share that kind of cool connection.
And that holds you to a higher standard, for sure.
Oh, absolutely. Or it gives me reason to, you know, when something goes bad, like, well, I'm the abbot's first monk, so you don't blame me. He's the one who accepted me. I don't know. So, just to start, Father Abbot, before we even talk about the whole cross aspect that you've gained, that's a designator of his office. His abbots are to wear a cross or a crucifix. How did you come to St. Vincent at all? And what is your story to entering the community here? were your eyes set on being Archabbot of St. Vincent from when you
were... My eyes were not even set on being Archabbot after I became Archabbot.
Oh,
but it's a kind of funny story, and it's not one that maybe... that maybe I should tell, just because I think I kind of come off looking desperate, but I'll tell the story anyway. I went to school on the East Coast in Philadelphia, and so I checked out just about every male religious order on the East Coast, up and down, from Boston to probably Baltimore anyway. I never quite clicked with any of them, and at the time I wasn't sure I wanted to be a priest. And some of them were pretty even clear that if you weren't going to be ordained, there wasn't much opportunity. Anyway, I graduated from college, went to work for a public accounting firm. I remember going to see my pastor Saturday night, 7 o'clock confessions. In the confessional, I told him, thought I had this vocation, but maybe not, because it was just, maybe I had this romantic notion of what religious life was all about. So maybe I should just call it quits. And my pastor at the time had been a Cistercian at Gethsemane before he became a parish priest for the Diocese of Cleveland. And he said to me with this glowing recommendation, well, I've heard there's this place in La Trobe, and they follow the rule of Saint Benedict, so they can't be all bad. So why don't you go and visit them, and then who knows what might happen, and if it's not for you, just you can feel confident you've given it a try, and then go on with your life. And I still remember that. That was Labor Day weekend of 1978. And if I could have stayed that weekend, I would have.
Wow.
In those days, we didn't have postulancy. You didn't enter at any other time except July 1st, when novices entered. But it was just something that kind of clicked and said, this is where I'm meant to be.
Wow, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. So did you enter that following year?
Correct, the next July 1st.
Okay. And so you've been now in the community for how many years?
Well, it will be, let's see, 20, almost 45.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, I came at the age of 3.
Right, exactly, right? Back when we still did accept children. that means you got your college degree at what, too? That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, well, I worked hard.
The youngest in public accounting as well.
Yeah, that story doesn't carry too far.
Well, you know, keep on telling. Whenever my mom has a birthday, my dad just says, oh, she turned 35 for like the 20th time. You know, so, mm-hmm. So what was your story afterwards? Because you did get ordained, so that was something that, did that come to you while you were here in the community, or did you discern that kind of before you came to St. Vincent that you did feel the call to priesthood as well?
Well, you know, for full transparency, I probably should tell you that when I came on July 1st, I wasn't sure maybe that I was going to stay. I didn't even bring my winter clothes with me because I thought, I'll be home by September. What do I even need? Anyway, that didn't turn out to be accurate. But no, I came with the notion of wanting to be a monk and not necessarily going to the seminary. I think it was a monk here. He happened to be spiritual director in the seminary at the time, who I thought was a great example of combining the monastic vocation with the priestly vocation. And it really was his example. God rest his soul. He's gone to glory, hopefully, certainly. And he just kind of embodied and lived that great combination. So I said, this I think is for me. So that's how, again, it wasn't like St. Paul falling off a horse or anything like that, but just a kind of gradual unfolding of, maybe this is what the Lord wants me to do in combination with my monastic vocation.
Sure. Yeah, which is not necessarily and that's a question I get from a lot of people is, oh, like, do you have to be a priest or can you be just a brother? And at St. Vincent, we kind of have gone through waves of where the focus maybe has been, or because near its founding it was majority brotherhood with some few priests, and then there was a time where it was almost everyone was ordained and there was very few who were stayed as brothers. Now we're kind of swinging back a little bit. I mean, it's still majority of those who enter the community end up pursuing ordination as well, but there's several monks around my years of profession who aren't pursuing ordination. And there's a lot of stories, I think, kind of like yours, that they did not enter with that initial interest, but after maybe some examples of other monks or even discernment of prayer here, that priesthood was something they felt called to.
Absolutely. I should add, I had two classmates in the community. Both of them are not ordained.
Okay.
And one loved to say, when someone would say to him, are you a priest or are you just a brother? He loved to say, no, I'm a just brother. Love to say that, especially when I was in his presence.
There you go. Cool snub. It is really interesting. And that's almost the kind of the casual thing we say to you. Oh, you can say just a brother, but it's not. Monastic life, consecrated life as a brother is not just you're just doing that. I mean, it's the backbone of St. Vincent was brotherhood. And that's the reason why it was built, the reason why it continues to be sustained, was on the backs of the brothers.
The craftsmen, yeah. For sure. It's interesting now to me, I didn't think we'd ever really be to this place, but now there is just no distinction. It used to be the only distinction that the abbot had to be a priest, and now with Pope Francis's recent change of law, or at least change of custom, however you want to put it. And as we have at St. Anselm's,
yes,
the abbot there is a brother.
So speaking of abbot, that's something that came obviously down the road. What were your assignments in the middle of that? You've been kind of all over the place in the things that you've done.
Sorry, I always think of a story no matter what I'm doing. I was teaching in the college, teaching accounting, statistics, a little business law. And the particularly gifted students, I would try to encourage them to go to grad school, maybe delay the paycheck and the nice car and all that to take advantage of educational opportunities. And I still remember one of them said, I don't know, Father, look at you. Look at all the years you went to school and you still don't have a decent job.
Wow.
So that put everything in perspective for me. After I finished seminary, I was encouraged to do some advanced studies. And there was nothing I thought that I had any aptitude for a PhD. But I wondered if I could go to law school because I saw that as a continuation of my MBA and CPA and such. Anyway, I went to Abbot Paul at the time and asked Abbot Paul if I could go to law school. And he said no. So he assigned me to the business office in the college where I worked for a year as, I think my title was assistant controller. In that intervening time period, I had time to think about it a little more, and I wrote up a memo indicating all the reasons that I thought I should be able to go to law school. And I, teaching taxation, maybe helping with our own tax returns for those guys that work outside the monastery and so have taxable income and so on, you know, helping guys with their parents that maybe need a quick will, that type of thing. And I still remember, and I was probably a little bit of a smart mouth, at the tail end of the page, I put, P.S., and who knows, I may be even able to keep an abbot out of jail.
Wow.
And bold it was, yes. I probably wouldn't tolerate somebody saying that to me now.
I was going
to
ask about that.
But the next day, I still remember I was in my room and I just saw a piece of white paper come under my door and it said approved. So then I ended up going to law school. When I was done with law school, then came back here and taught. I was grateful the first year the abbot did not ask me to go to the dorms. So the first year I could just devote myself to teaching. And then after that, I think for about 8 years, I lived in first Girard Hall and then Rooney Hall. And it was, it could be challenging living with a bunch of college kids, but it was also very rewarding at the same time.
Because I know that there's like different phases of why the monks were there. Were you the like RHD dorm moderator on top of it all?
Yes. Unlike what I call the current soft monks,
yeah, right.
We were actually disciplinarians. We made the rounds in the dormitory on the weekend, I think, till maybe 1 a.m., and then we stayed up till 2 a.m. Mm-hmm. to make sure things were quiet, and then we could go to bed. But yes, in those days, we took a regular dorm duty and had to be a little bit of a disciplinarian.
Having been a prefect here at the college, just and knowing all of that was involved, having put myself back into that as a monk, I would not be thrilled. The number of situations, the most bizarre things that have to happen, and always after 1 a.m. You know, it can't happen at 10 when I'm like kind of alert or something. It's always 1:30. I think the funniest story I had when I was a prefect was that we were on our final rounds, which is 2 a.m. and those are on the weekends, the visitation rounds. So if guys are visiting girls' rooms or vice versa, they have to be out before that round.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm in St. Benedict Hall, so it's all freshmen, and with my rounds partner Ryan, and we're in like one of the last pods, right? It always happens, like one of the last. And we even start the rounds like a few minutes later, just so that, you know, if there's some stragglers, we don't catch them and we don't have to write up the report or anything. Well, we come around to this like last room, and the door's wide open, and it's a girls' pod. And there's like 8 guys all in this girl's room. And they're just watching a movie. And just knock, and like, hey, guys, it's, you know, it's like 2:15, you know, your past visitation. And they're like, oh, no, too bad. I'm like, oh, yeah, we're sorry. And they just go back to watching the movie. Like, okay, you know, that means you actually have to get out. And what was really particular about this dorm is we heard that there was a squatter, a non-student, who was like, going from room to room, like spending time in other people's rooms, but not actually paying any tuition. They were a student, but they just didn't want to pay to room.
Mm-hmm.
So they're no boards. They're just like, so we're trying to find out who it is, and we're pretty sure he's in there. But you know, we're not really sure. So we're like, okay, can we get like your guys' ID so we can write stuff down? And the girls were very cooperative. They're like, yep, sorry, here you go. But the guys were getting really, really cagey. Like, oh, like, I think I left my ID in my room. They were like, okay, well, we'll follow you up to go get it. Like, my roommate locked my room and I don't have a key. Like, well, we can unlock it for you. Like, I don't know about it. Just kept going on. So finally, like, okay, who's your prefect? And, you know, this blank stare gets on his face and goes, my prefect's Ryan Farrell. And that was my partner, who was standing right there. Of all, like, the 24 prefects today, he names my partner. And he goes, I'm Ryan Farrell. I'm not your prefect. And he goes, I said a lot of things that I probably shouldn't say on this podcast. But suffice it to say, when you had to write up the report, it's, you know, resident so-and-so says, my prefect is Ryan Farrell. Prefect Ryan Farrell says, no, you're not. It was entertaining having to stay up that late, but yeah.
You had more entertainment, I guess, than I did. I think the worst, I wouldn't even call it the worst. One night we had, I think, about 11 inches of snow, and it happened right around midnight or so. Might have been the first snow of the season. So a certain group of students decided that they were going to see who could last out in the snow in just their underwear.
Oh.
No shoes,
wow.
No t-shirt, no nothing, no hat, just, I don't know if you'd call that streaking, because they were wearing some clothes, but it was kind of hard to get that under control at 2 a.m.
Wow, that's... How long, do you know how long during the last
No. I think I turned that over to the student prefects at some point.
That's great. So you were working here in the college, but then you took... There was a time you were not here either, too.
Right. Well, I did some administrative jobs for a while here. The academic dean, I think, went on sabbatical, so I was an acting academic dean for a year. And then the provost took a sabbatical for half a year. So I was the acting provost for that time period. And then I went back to teaching, and then I was actually president of the college for 5 years. After that, it just, administration is not everybody's cup of tea, I guess. And I did what I thought I could do, but I don't really think administration is my cup of tea. You monks will find out within the next couple of years. So I asked if I could just have a different experience of ministry, and that was to go out to a parish. There was part of me that just wanted to see God's creation from more than 18 to 21-year-olds or 17 to 22-year-olds. Nothing wrong with collegians. Love them. Glad they're here. But I just wanted to see the variety of God's creation. So I ended up going out to a parish. I loved, in particular, my first parish because it had a great name. St. Martin in Newderry.
There you go.
And what fun I had answering the phone, St. Martin.
Wow.
So that was great fun. Wasn't Martin de Porres, Martin of Tours, but nevertheless, it was a good... And it was a small country parish. Just the kind of parish you just didn't even think existed anymore, but a very rural... there were people, say, that couldn't afford to put much in the collection basket, but when they butchered the pig, I got a ham. Or when the cow got butchered, I got a couple of steaks and things like that. Again, kind of old time, but very strong, faith-filled people. From there, then, the abbot asked me to become pastor at St. Bruno's in South Greensburg. And I was there till 2013, and then I went to the Diocese of Pittsburgh, St. Francis Cabrini in Center Township, a town just outside of Aliquippa.
And you were there until the fateful day?
Until June 19th, 2020.
And I've heard, I don't know if this is true, that when you came here for the election, you only packed, you barely packed anything. You had zero... thoughts that you would be one of the ones whose name was put on the nominations.
Well, as you well know, monks talk.
There's no campaigning, but monks campaign for each other a little bit. As a novice, I had several monks say, like, well, you want so-and-so to be elected abbot. I'm like, well, I have zero say in this. I don't even know half these people.
Well, I hadn't lived here. By that time, I hadn't lived here almost 20 years. So I wasn't even sure that the monks really knew who I was. And I certainly didn't know the last generation of monks when I came back. So, yeah, I thought we would... I think we started on June 19th. I thought by June 20th, I'd be back in my car and back in Aliquippa. And... things went a different way. So it was a little surprising. I mean, at some point it became obvious, but early on it was a little surprising.
Sure. So now that you've been abbot for 4 years, going back to the story when you told Abbot Paul, kind of like, here are all the reasons I don't like your no. How would you feel receiving that? Or what's been like your experience even on the other end of things now with figuring out where monks are to be assigned or where to put people? What's it like having the responsibility of the largest abbey in the United States?
Mm-hmm. Well, I do have to say, I think I was either naive or just plain stupid. I had no idea how much of an abbot's time was taken up in personnel. I think I had been in the abbot's office maybe 3-4 times, just based on my 3 or 4 different assignments over the course of 20 some years or so. I had no idea that personnel and staffing and trying to find the right match for a monk and the right ministry for that monk, that type of thing, I had no idea how much time would be involved in that. That was a learning, that was a steep learning curve at the beginning. I do have to say, I think keeping a sense of humor about the whole thing has been very helpful to me. Like, I hope Abbot Paul, I hope to meet up with him again in the hereafter someday and find out for sure that he took that as a kind of tongue-in-cheek joke rather than anything else. He never did go to jail, though, while I was licensed to practice law. It's difficult. And then given our wide variety, like, it's hard to know the 30 monks in Brazil. Mm-hmm. It's hard to know the, 6-7 monks in Taiwan. And it's hard to know even the monks here in the United States, but that aren't stationed here. So I did kind of make a vow to myself when I was elected, as a monk who felt like he was outside and kind of isolated for all those years, that I was going to visit every single monk annually in his native habitat, like they would say about the zoo. And I didn't get to do that, obviously, the first 2 years because of COVID.
Sure.
But since then, I've been pretty good about that. There's just something about being there and experiencing their life there as they live it that helps me to understand them a little better.
And would you say that getting that, whether it's that unexpected level of attention to personnel or other things, have posed some unexpected challenges of being, and we'll get to unexpected excitements or joys, but what, like, some challenges you didn't expect, or even some, like, ideals of, like, oh, when I'm abbot, I'll get to really invest in each brother a little bit more specifically, and now it's a little bit more administration than you were hoping?
I guess I didn't realize how complicated the personnel decisions were going to be, because, you know, sometimes people will joke a little bit about, well, you're the abbot, you can just order it. Father Jacques, of happy memory, used to say, I think at one point he said he was going to vote for me for abbot, and I asked him something like, you know, do you not like me that much? Oh, he said, come on, we all know the abbot just sits around and tells the monks what to do all day, and they do it like that. And I said, okay, Jacques, you must know an abbot that I don't know there. It never makes sense to me to try to ask or try to place somebody in an assignment that doesn't work for them. And that isn't to say that people haven't stretched themselves, but if someone just really feels it's not a good match, let's say teaching high school, and I use that example because I don't think I have any gift for teaching high school. Was never asked to, but I just don't think that I would. So for me to ask a monk who feels very uncomfortable about teaching high school to go down to Savannah and teach in the high school, I'm just not sure that the students are well served. Not sure that the monk is well served. I don't know that the community is well served, because we have a monk maybe that's not functioning to his best capacity. So trying to find that niche, and especially when the niche might be a little small, and trying to fit that and make it happen can be very challenging sometimes. Although you said you were going to ask me later, it's fantastic when it does fit. And especially when it fits for 3 or 4 monks at a time, because this one goes here and that one goes there and this one goes there, and they all seem happy about it, and then they all end up being productive. You just feel like you've won the chess game.
Besides that, what are some other maybe unexpected things that you've enjoyed, or maybe even just in regards to, like, being reintegrated into community life but in a different aspect, that you found fulfilling or rejuvenating in your own monasticism?
One thing is just the prayer life. I found it very difficult in a parish, and especially when I was stationed alone, I found it very difficult to maintain my prayer life, especially kind of my public prayer life, or the liturgy of the hours, in other words, because it always seemed like there was something ready to get in the way, take my place, another commitment. I'm not going to, or if somebody needs to be anointed at the emergency room, I'm not going to say I need to do Vespers before I do that. Right, I want to get there. So that was a little difficult. And to get back here where it's part of the schedule, and there are other monks counting on you and you're counting on them, just that added, I don't know that I'd even call it pressure, that's too strong, but that added expectation that we are going to be there for each other, for morning prayer, for Mass, for midday prayer, for evening prayer. That's very helpful to me because I think I need that little nudge. Probably maybe I shouldn't be saying that as an abbot, but the abbot needs the nudge too, just like the newest novice on campus.
I think that's something that, you know, just to speak from my own experience of being a monk under you, that has been really helpful for me to see is, well, yes, you know, you're the father of the community and you're in charge of our community. Also, I've just really experienced like the mutuality that still exists. That there, it's not this, oh, you know, abbot reigns over the community like some kind of king. But I mean, whether it's just like kind of sometimes goofy conversations we have at lunch, playing euchre at recreation, or just how it doesn't, you know, seem like there's such an obvious divide between like those who are just part of the community and those who are leaders, really helps me to understand that we're striving for that unity. And I mean, that's your whole motto, right? Brothers together as one.
Mm-hmm.
That I think, at least in my concept, when I first came to the monastery, it was that rank. And Benedict talks about order and rank, that like rank is like everything here. So like, when you rank as a novice, you're the absolute lowest. Don't even possibly expect that you could help, assist, or, you know, offer advice to anyone. You're dirt here. And then you slowly have to earn the respect and, you know, the whatever you want to call it, until you get to a point where, oh, you know, you have the credence now to be able to guide people, be able to talk to people, or to add in conversation when there's seniors there. But maybe it's just because of the dynamic of entering as your first professed monk, but just that connection that I've never really, and maybe that's something you should tell me I need to work on, but I've never really felt like this like demand of, you're Father Abbot, you're worlds beyond or above me, that I couldn't approach you like on like a normal brotherly level at the same time.
Actually, I take that as a great compliment. Thank you. Thank you very much. And actually, you talked about a challenge. Maybe that is the number one challenge, even more so than staffing personnel. I feel I was the same person on June 19th as I was on June 20th. But because of what Abbot signifies in the rule and in our life, I feel like for many of the monks, I was now some different kind of creature.
Yeah.
The monks who knew me from way back when, maybe not so much, but the younger guys who didn't know me at all, and I guess didn't know how I was going to respond to them, maybe joking with me or whatever. It was, you know, I'm still the same person I was before.
Right.
I understand I have a little authority, a little responsibility, but to be treated just 100% difference just because an election took place, to me, seemed very odd. But it just is the way it is, I guess.
Some of the nature.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I would, and even my family has even commented on that sometimes. So I was saying something, I was like, oh yeah, well, I texted the abbot about that. And my dad's like, you text the abbot? Like, yeah, like, oh, why wouldn't I? I even shared, like we had like a joking conversation back and forth a while ago. And he says, you're allowed, you can do that with the abbot? I'm like, yeah, Dad, I mean, in a way, like, I text you back and forth and make jokes with you in the same way, like the abbot's like the spiritual correlative there.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I certainly appreciate it, but I can imagine that at times it's challenging to be in that place. You mentioned the rule, which is something I wanted to ask you about. The second chapter of the Rule of Saint Benedict talks about the kind of man the abbot should be. And there's some tall orders there. In particular, a little scary, too. And when he talks about that the abbot is, in a special way, held responsibly to Christ the judge at the end of his life for his entire community. How has that chapter, shifted its meaning to you? And, how do you connect with it, or what motivates you, what kind of deters, scares you, whatever?
Well, before I answer that, could I just go back to the comment you made before? I think the highest compliment that any monk has paid me since I was elected abbot was, "You are almost like a regular person." I am almost like a regular person.
And that's about as close as a compliment
I can get. I can't go any further, no bigger. Anyway.
Retire now.
And actually, you were kind when you said the kind of person that the abbot should be. What I have noticed is when we read that isn't the translation that most monks get a great deal of joy out of reading, and that is, on what kind of man the abbot ought to be. That usually gets emphasized every time. Even if that's not the word in the translation, it gets changed to what kind of man the abbot ought to be. But on a more serious level, I have to say, probably that first year or so, I was listening to the rule at dinner, and it was something about the abbot again, and I thought, I never remember all these references to the abbot before I was elected abbot. That can't be the same rule that I studied some years ago. I mean, there is a fair amount in there of the responsibility that the abbot ought to have. And I thought, oh man, another thing. But actually, I think I'd take it as I'm looking for holiness and striving for holiness right along with everybody else. So I think I always have to remember that. I know I have a special role with it, but I'm usually striving for it myself, even as I'm trying to beckon others to do the same. So it's not anything that I have it all figured out and all the monks need to just imitate me and then we'll all be happy.
Right.
As much as I'd love that to be the case sometimes, but it's, hey, I'm striving right there along with you, brothers, and let's see what, you challenge me and I'll challenge you, and hopefully we can get there together.
Have you felt, or you experienced, has your prayer life been different since you've become an abbot?
Well, this is embarrassing to say, but it's the truth. I mentioned to you the notion of staffing and personnel,
right, right,
and how that does kind of occupy my brain. I am embarrassed to say that too often at Vespers, instead of maybe praying and praising the Lord, I am looking, I wonder if he could be the pastor that we're looking for St. James Church. I wonder how he'd be. And then as soon as I catch myself doing that, I try to get back to what I should be doing. But in choir, when we're all gathered there, that's kind of my equivalent of going through the ordo of I wonder if he ever thought about teaching high school or that type of thing. So I'm not proud of that, but I do have to say the staffing gets the staffing and personnel and appointments do tend to get in my mind that way. I don't know if you ever heard this story, but in 1980 we had a big celebration here for the 1500th anniversary of Benedict's birth, and Cardinal Basil Hume, Benedictine abbot of Ampleforth, was here for the occasion. It was really quite a celebration. I was a novice that year. Seems to me it happened in February or March. It was a fall thing, like September, October. Anyway, he gave a couple of conferences to us while he was here. And I know he said many other things, and he probably said many other more edifying things. But the thing I remember him saying up in our novitiate study hall, addressing the whole community, was, "Boys, remember that when you die, at least one monk will be greatly relieved." And And it just kind of puts things in perspective, lest one get thinking too highly of themselves.
And that connects directly to one of the steps of humility that Benedict mentions, is that a monk not think any more highly of himself than he ought to think. And that becomes an immediate cause for division. And he talks about grumbling. And I think that like the two are immediately connected, that if one thinks more highly of themselves, then anyone who, you know, pushes against that or they feel like opposes that ego is a cause for grumbling and complaining. They say, now I'm going to find something about you that I don't like because you don't validate me. You don't see what's so great about me. Everyone else seems to notice it. Mm-hmm. And then grumbling, Benedict says, is like the worst sin in the community because it just rips it apart. That was a non-sequitur, I suppose.
I feel like you've given me an Abbot's Conference now. Good. That's all good.
You can hold that for later. I guess the last question. Has there been anything you've learned about yourself since becoming an abbot that maybe... I know you said, you know, you felt the same, you were the same person from June 19th to June 20th. But has there been over the 4 years that you've kind of like, oh, wow, that maybe I was aware of that, but I wasn't aware to that extent. And now it's almost been put in the spotlight for you since you've become an abbot.
I think that the first thing that comes to my mind is it's difficult. Confrontation or challenging people was never my strength. It was never something I sought to do. But in my role as abbot, I realized that it was my responsibility to do. So I think maybe that worked to my benefit, though. I tried never to jump to conclusions, never to act in haste, trying to never act in haste. But my reluctance to act then made me sit back a little bit and analyze and think and pray about it and try to understand another perspective. So it's made me be, I think, a little more patient, because it's one thing to, you know, you can jump to conclusions if the only one that's jumping is yourself. But when you are jumping to conclusions and the person you're talking to is going to be jumping because of your, you want to be careful there. So it's made me be a little more calm, a little more patient, a little maybe more analytical about a situation. But can I tell you the beautiful thing that has come out of that is I have had some difficult conversations with monks, and I went in kind of in fear and trembling, thinking I was going to get a little bit of a blowback, or maybe a lot of blowback. And I can't think of a case right now. There may have been one. I cannot think of a case now where the monk didn't ultimately say, thank you for bringing that to my attention. You know, you live in the community. We struggle sometimes with people who have kind of removed themselves, and for whatever reasons. And I did take, based on even the previous visitation 5 years ago, having read that the community was anxious to try to bring people back to the mainstream, and particularly back to prayers.
Right.
And there were people older than me in religion in the community, and I very gingerly asked if I could see them. I think everyone responded with, thank you for noticing. Thank you for calling that to my attention. No one ever did that before. I take that you care about me because you say that. So that's been a great surprise, frankly, because I'm not sure I would have been thankful myself if I'd have been called on the carpet that way. But then it makes it, when you have those good experiences, it makes it easier then to have a rational conversation about other difficult topics.
So Benedict says that the abbot is the Abba, or the father of the community. And in a sense, the monks were like really receiving like you as the father of the community there. It's like no one said that to me before. No one saw me there. Like as the dad or the father should see the things that his sons need, they just kind of didn't have that. And so being able to step into that, I mean, you're a priest, so you understand that fatherly role, but it's very different to be, you know, like spiritual father of the laity versus spiritual father of professed religious, I mm-hmm. can assume. You know, I don't know actually either of those yet. But yeah, so that is, thank you for that.
That's yeah. Really cool. Well, and especially when the monk, even jokingly, but when the monk says, "I knew you when you were a snot-nosed novice,"
yeah, right,
kind of
right.
thing.
Yeah.
Yes, you did.
That's crazy.
Yes, you did, and you called me on the carpet when I needed it. But now things are reversed.
Mm. Very good. Well, thank you, Father Abbott. Yeah,
my pleasure. My pleasure.
Spending some time with us, and hopefully, you all learned a little bit something about monasticism and the unique. role that we have in our chat with Martin. If you have any further questions, then maybe we could aim towards Father Abbott. Feel free to drop them in the comment section below. If there's anything you learned that you found interesting, you know, share this with someone, and do the thing that all the influencers ask you to do, to like, subscribe, and all that stuff. So, Father Abbott, could we have your blessing to close?
Absolutely. May the Lord God, who is the source of all health and healing and wholeness and wisdom, bless you now and forever, in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Adios.